This is On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with news, features, and special guests. Now, here's your host, Penny Wolfgang.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to On Target, and thank you so much for joining me today. I'm your host, Penny Wolfgang, and we are here every week talking about subjects that we think are interesting and important for all of us who live here in the Western New York community. And no matter where you live, I think the issue of refugees and immigrants is something that is at the top of your mind and the top of everyone's conversation and the top of the news for quite a while now. And we have our very own experts here in Western New York and people who I think I've introduced to you before from the International Institute who have been working very hard over all the years, not just recently when it's been in the news, but so much, but for many years, to make Western New York a better place for immigrants and refugees and to welcome them and help them and work with foreign-born people and encourage our region's support for diverse cultures, which is in their mandate of the International Institute. And our guests today are going to fill us in on a lot of what's been going on and what's happening in Western New York regarding this. And I think you may remember having the meeting Jennifer Rizzo Choi before, right?
Yes.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago.
A couple months ago, though so much has changed, Judge. So much.
Oh, my gosh. Everything changes in a couple of months? Well, we're going to find out. And although he insists on remaining silent, Gabe DiMaio, who is with us here, who is the communications director and an old friend. You can just say hi.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Judge.
Okay.
Thanks for having us on.
Gabe is an old friend of us here at Odyssey. Anyway, so you said a lot has changed, Jennifer, but I want maybe just to just give like a brief background of what the International Institute does here in Western New York. What is their mission?
Absolutely. The International Institute of Buffalo, our mission is making Western New York a better place for and because of immigrants and refugees. And we have been delivering on that mission since 1918 when we were founded. Yep, that long.
Okay, that's a long time ago. I know it's so unusual that a place that has been working as you have for all these years should, oh, there it is, right, since 1918 in the information, should become so, oh, gosh, such a hot topic, so, you know, so much in the news in the last, 10 years maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's unfortunately because immigration has become a politicized subject. But really, if you reflect back to 1918, you know, in the last 100 years, pretty much everyone has to come from somewhere. Only in the last census, 1% of individuals in our country were actually native-born to the United States territories. That means that everybody else came from somewhere. And I think that's a big part of the story of the International Institute, whether it was Italians and Irish or Polish and Germans or, you know, Jewish refugees or today's refugees coming from places like Sudan, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Ukraine. Everyone comes from somewhere and has to make a start here in their home. And our job is to help them settle in, to get them housing, to introduce them to employers and get them their first job, get their kids enrolled in school, get them started so they can be successful members of our community.
Well, it's so true when you say that about, you know, everything coming, but it was in the old days at the beginning, it was waves of people coming from, I think it was different areas. It was Europe mostly.
Yeah.
And then it changed, obviously, as the years went by. But there's something that people always say, which is, why were the people who came so many years ago, why did they get integrated so easily, pretty much? Why did they learn English so quickly and become part of our society, whereas now it seems that people are not?
That's an interesting question. And I think it goes back to perception. You know, I was recently perusing through our archives. We actually have a lot of our documents and records of people that we served in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And it's a fascinating read because it's written from the perspective of a landed individual. There were a lot of the settled Buffalonians of prominence back then that founded the Italian women's community, which is what we were originally called. You know, they were German descent, English descent, Northern European descent, the people who came in the 1800s, right? And so their view of the newer European immigrants, Italians in particular, other Southern European immigrants, was sort of a distasteful view of them in the sense that they felt that people did not seem to learn English, did not seem to have parenting skills, seemed to struggle with family bonds and getting permanent employment. And so, you know, if you look at sort of the discussion in those like committee meetings, there was this view of, well, this group's having a harder time integrating. And I think probably if you talk to some people, they would say the same today of people who come here and speak another language. It takes time to make a new community and make a home. It's not going to happen in a year or 2 years. You know, you have to learn the language of the homeland that you're now in. You know, you have to get comfortable enough that you have neighbors and friends you can trust. And you have to move to a place that you have continually steady enough employment that there's a reliability that you're going to buy a house, buy a car. I think everybody's journey has taken time. And it's not that the generation ago people integrated faster than today's immigrant groups. I think the process was probably very similar. It just looked different based on, you know, what language they spoke when they arrived here, whether it was Italian versus Arabic today.
Maybe it also looks different in behind because of time. You know, looking back on it, looking back is a different perspective that people have.
Definitely. And, you know, different events drive migration. I mean, why did the Irish show up here? Well, they had the potato famine. You know, there was nothing to eat there. It's not that people wanted to leave Ireland. I think if you talk to a lot of the Irish folks in Buffalo, they'll tell you how they've gone back to visit their roots and done some of those tours, right? I mean, they love being Irish. There's a cultural center here. There's dancing classes here. But they had their ancestors had to leave there because there just wasn't enough food or work to be able to feed their family. You know, today's groups that are coming here that are refugee populations are coming because of conflict and war or persecution about something that is so personal to them that they cannot change, what's called an immutable characteristic under the law, like their race, their religion, the color of their skin. And so they're fleeing safety because they don't want to die in their homeland on account of that. So everyone's journey here is different, but once they're here, it's the same in that they're making Western New York home.
Go back to the reasons, to explaining the reasons why people can legally come to seek, like are they seeking, you just mentioned, for safety or for, I don't know. And also, I need you to explain, which people talk about all the time, why coming here to our country for a job, to work, is not considered a reason why you are legitimately, legally coming here, allowed to come here. Am I explaining that right?
Yes,
absolutely. You know what I'm asking?
Economic migration you're talking about.
Oh, thank you.
And so let's talk the law, right? Let's talk the legal landscape. So after World War II, the nations of the world decided to agree to a framework in how countries would accept in refugees. Recognizing that there's the movement of lots of people due to conflict and upheaval, understanding that everyone would agree to certain terms. And so the United Nations passed a convention in 1951 on the status of rights of refugee. And so that spells out the definition of what is a refugee under international law. And that has been adopted into U.S. law in 1980 with the Refugee Act of 1980. So a refugee, under the legal sense, is someone who has fled his or her own homeland on account of persecution on the basis of their race, religion, national identity, political opinion, or particular social group. So you have a bunch of elements in there, but they have to be outside their homeland. They have to have suffered persecution or fear persecution if they return. And there's those five bases, race, religion, political opinion, nationality, or particular social group. In those five boxes I just mentioned, economic migration is not one of them. Certainly people, like we talked about with the Irish, coming here because of the potato famine, they're fleeing to survive. But economic migration was never named in the Refugee Convention nor in U.S. law. And so that has always been a sort of a sense of tension in our law, because people do show up here and they haven't had persecution happen to them in any other means, but they're not able to get refugeehood and stay. People who show up here that don't go through the refugee application process overseas are people who are often referred to as asylum seekers or economic migrants.
Oh, thank goodness you mentioned that, because that was one of my questions.
Yeah, people who are seeking asylum are essentially trying to say that they are a refugee, but they have to meet that legal definition. And they go through their adjudication in a court system on U.S. soil instead of having it happen overseas. Same definition, and it's actually a pretty high burden to meet that threshold. But where their determined status is awarded to them or denied to them will determine their path and their future. So people who show up here seeking asylum often show up in greater numbers than those who seek refugee status and are allowed in through the formal resettlement program administered by the federal government.
Now, you also hear a lot about people coming because a relative. I'm coming because my son is here, or my, I don't know, child is here. Or I can't, but a family member. And now I'm coming, I want to come here to be with my family member. How does that work? Is that a legitimate way to come and become a citizen?
So that is a pathway, but it is also not easy to get in through via legal means. Family sponsorship is what you're referring to. If you are someone here who is a U.S. citizen or has a green card, depending on your status, you have the ability to sponsor certain named family members. So you can't just sponsor your second cousin or your brother's wife. Like, I mean, it's pretty narrow. If you have a green card and you're the sponsor, your beneficiaries are a small group of people. It would be spouse and children. Once you become a U.S. citizen, you have the ability to sponsor a larger options of family members, including adult parents, siblings. But those people, some of them have to wait for a visa. So family sponsorship can mean lots of money and lots of time spent waiting, upwards of anywhere from 5 to 30 years. People can wait for a visa. Yep, there are visas and limits every year, and there are limits on how many per nationality can come in. So there's a narrow category of family reunification that is allowed for resettlement refugees, but that's a pretty narrow group. When people talk about bringing family members here, they usually are referring to family sponsorship. That is something that I understand the Trump administration is looking at cutting off entirely, as the topic of immigration continues to be discussed and looked at. One of the prevailing discussions now has been about reframing the entire immigration system and not having it be based on family sponsorship, but having it be based on other things that are key to the labor market, including like skill sets or priority skill areas.
You know, I always thought, that shows how little I know, I guess, that there was a way, like if you had a specific job, employment, skill, that you could come here. That you could come, like if you were a certain kind of an engineer, then you could claim. Or for some reason, you know, knowing me, actors are on my mind. I remember.
If you're an actor, you can come here. There's a special visa for those folks.
Honestly?
There is.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Sort of like an outstanding performer visa. I mean, Justin Bieber is always the classic example brought up because he's Canadian. Certainly, there are people that qualify for certain narrow visas. There are some employment-based visas that employers can sponsor you on. You know, the one that's often talked about is the H-1B, but there's also L visas, there's TNs. That's not really the area that the Institute practices in, because those are immigrants who are coming with financial means and can pay. But to start that process, you need to have a specifically defined skill set that the U.S. wants, and you would need to have an employer that's willing to file the paperwork and bring you forth on a sponsorship.
Because I think that was in the news quite a bit. But anyway, what we really want to talk about is what your issues are. what is happening with the International Institute. How overwhelmed are you? How are you able to meet the demand that is so, not just suddenly, but within the last, I don't know, 10 years maybe, has been, are you overwhelmed or how are you meeting the needs?
We've been through a lot of different phases of change in the last, you know, even 4 years of my tenure at the Institute. At one point, you know, there was a lot of refugees coming in under President Biden, and, you know, we had upwards of 80 employees. And with the new administration coming in and suspending the refugee admissions program, which is that security vetted pipeline to bring people in here through refugee status, we are now today down to 35 employees. And, you know, with uncertainty looking ahead in the future related to our funding, a lot of our federal funding has been cut. State funding is impacted. We are grateful to have it, although I see looking further out next year and the year after that I think it's going to diminish because there are no refugees coming in. January 20th was when an executive order was put into effect that suspended the U.S. refugee admissions program. So we have not had a single new arrival client from overseas since then. Not one. We have new clients, people who live in the region who've come in to, you know, they've come back to us. Maybe they were served by another agency. People who lived in other states that were resettled there and came to New York. So we have lots of clients, but we are no longer doing resettlement because the government essentially shut it down as of January.
I'm just going to interrupt for a moment in case you just tuned in. You are listening to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang. And our guests today are Jennifer Rizzo Choi from the International Institute and Gabe DiMaio, who is, I don't know, trying to say something or tell Jennifer to say something. But what do we want to add to what we were just saying?
I was just, instead of interrupting the conversation, I just wanted to remind to just say, you know, the International Institute, while that's an important part of our business, there are many other things that the International Institute has done and continues to do, even with the refugee pipeline being shut off.
Okay, and we're going to, that is a good point. And I actually was thinking of asking Jennifer that without your help, Gabe.
He keeps us honest.
Yeah. what are the other services? That's a really good point. Well, I'm going to answer myself about the one that we always needed and turned to you for in court when we need people to interpret in different languages. I don't know what we would do without the International Institute.
Thank you for that. And that's a core service that's been around since the beginning of our founding. We can provide language interpretation in over 100 languages. Interpretation is spoken language. We also can do written translation, which is documents. And those services are so critical. I mean, certainly courts, hospitals, schools. We do over 1,000 appointments monthly. So it's a nice revenue stream for us, but it's also a key service to the community in places sometimes that you wouldn't even expect. So as an example, that terrible bus accident that happened recently on the I-90, we actually ended up providing interpreters to dispatch and in the hospitals. In fact, as they were extracting victims from the bus, it was a bus that contained a lot of foreign tourists who spoke Mandarin, Cantonese, Arabic, and Indian languages. As they got somebody out, they had sent a road deputy, to our building. So we had dispatch routing through our building, calling him, saying, we're sending this victim to XYZ Hospital, and they need Cantonese. And so then we would arrange and send an interpreter there. So, everybody needs to be able to communicate in their own language. And certainly in a time of emergency, reliable, accurate interpretation is critical to providing life-saving services like what happened that day. The Institute's proud to continue to do those services, and I would say that service has remained consistent and is actually pretty booming in business. Our employment program is also really busy because as we're serving people who are here, we are also seeing an influx of people coming from other states where it's not feeling as welcoming, and they know that there's more supportive services in a state like New York. So we work with over 60 area employers, place people in jobs, a lot of light manufacturing, housekeeping, cleaning, food service, beverage industry, that type of thing. And then we also have a skilled program that's called Professional Pathways, and people who have a background that can be translated, like medical backgrounds, finance backgrounds. We work to do recredentialing. We can pay for some classes and get them into a similar skilled environment as to the one that they left. So that's also a very busy program as well. The Institute's just been busy ever since, you know, the change in politics has not stopped us. It's just we look a little bit different size-wise, and some of our funding has disappeared.
It is amazing to me. I did read about the bus accident and how important it was that, you know, that you were available or had people available to speak these different languages. And, like, you just put to be on the scene, because imagine trying to tell the doctor, you know, in the hospital or the first responder what hurts you or where you, you know, where you need help. It's crucial.
I mean, in-person interpretation in particular is really important in medical situations as well as court, to be able to read body language and things. You're right. I mean, it was such a terrible incident that brought forth the clear power of language access and how crucial that is. And I can't imagine how scared those people were, trapped and in a foreign country and needing, like, serious medical aid. You know, I'm glad that we were able to provide services in that moment. I also think that, you know, what was amazing is they called us. We have longstanding relationships with entities like the county, the 911 dispatch, you know, the court system, the hospitals. And so we were already, you know, qualified to go into their facilities, background checked, badged, all those things. So we could immediately deploy on the scene and do those services.
What else?
Educational services are something I wanted to talk about as well. We run the area model UN program for high schools. And we want to talk about that more, because this is the time of the year that we recruit teams, because they end up doing their big competition in March. But this is something, as the school starts, that social studies teachers, global studies teachers can start thinking about. We had over 900 students participate in this past Model UN cycle, over 40 area high schools, and we want to continue to grow that, because we live in a global world, as you started out by saying. This is a diverse community, and we're in a global world, and it's great to have programming that allows our kids at, like, 10th and 11th grade level to start accessing that and realizing that as they go out to become adults and that function in our world. Beyond that, we offer a lot of different trainings and things, cultural competency trainings, area employers, court systems, places that interact with the foreign-born population. I mean, even in the example of the bus accident, you know, a road deputy needs to be aware of the fact that there's going to be all different kinds of people in this community, not just someone who was born and raised in Buffalo. And so you can hire the Institute to do trainings to make your employees aware of how to serve the various communities that live in Western New York.
That would be really crucial for a lot of the companies when they need, you know, certain labor or engineering or AI maybe even, to be able to know how to deal with their employees who may have the skills but don't have the cultural aspect, right? And don't know how things are done here, because they're done differently in every country in the world.
Absolutely. And if you've traveled, as I know you have, You recognize that every country has a different system and process, right? And it's just about educating people to understand the way things are done and the expectations of here. Another example of educational programming that we do is health literacy. There are things that are in our health system that just didn't exist for people back home, like breast cancer screening and awareness, doing self-exams, colonoscopies. You know, they keep updating that, and you have to get younger and younger now to get your first colonoscopy. That's something that making people aware that they have the access to here, they can get those screenings, they can be proactive about their health services. And we provide that training to hospitals as well as to the refugee populations here, to be aware of when they go into the doctor, these are the kinds of things they're going to ask about.
I never thought of a lot of that, so I'm glad we had an opportunity, right? Did we forget anything that we want to talk about, Gabe?
You know, one of the things that I've always loved about the International Institute is the you know, they are the sort of witness to the immigrant history in Western New York. You know, we've been out here for over 100 years. And so every population that comes in, I always like to say at work, you know, the stories are very similar, only the names are spelled differently. And we celebrate the cultures of everybody who's come to Western New York, and we're really a locus for people to come in and to use our space, but also to go out and inform those who may not really know about various cultures the beauty of the tapestry that's in Western New York, because having lived around the country, you know, it's not like that in a lot of places. So this is something to celebrate. The diversity of the people who live here is actually a great thing, aside from really good food.
Yes, know. We do. We should talk about that a lot, right?
Yeah.
How we have every kind of food.
We've benefited from from so many different cultures coming here and settling, for sure. And the Institute's been trying to find different ways to bring people together over food. We had a cultural night on site back in August, and we have our big event coming up this fall. And we always try to make sure there's really good, diverse, global food, because that often is the way to people's hearts.
Good. It's good timing. Tell us about the event.
Absolutely. We just put information up on our website, so you're able to buy tickets, or, you know, if you own a company and you'd like to do a sponsorship, or if you just, you know, have some money you'd like to donate, buying a corporate sponsorship would be terrific. Our event is called The Refugees of Comedy. This is our third year hosting it. It is wildly successful in that we have brought back some amazing talent, and we have been able to sell more seats each year. So I hope that you're able to come this year. It will be held on October 15th. So that's coming up in just under 2 months, and it's at Buffalo Toronto Public Media Studios. Tickets are on sale at www.iibuffalo.org, and it's a comedy event. So we have our lead headliner is a guy named Tom Tran, who is very well connected to the Institute. We resettled him as a child with his family. He's a refugee from Vietnam. He's made it big in Hollywood, though. He's a guy that's a regular at the Laugh Factory. He's got a bunch of movie credits to his name. And he comes every year and donates his time. And he brings comedian friends with him. So this year he is bringing two comics who are also very popular out in L.A. We've got Matt Kirshen, who is a British immigrant. And he has spent some time. He was a finalist on NBC's Last Comic Standing. And we're also having Karina Yi, who is a Chinese immigrant. She was actually adopted from China. And she is also a regular on the comedy scene in L.A. So this is a one-night-only thing in Buffalo that you can get access to by buying tickets.
Okay, so tell everyone in the last minute that we have how they can get tickets, where?
Absolutely. So easiest way is www.iibuffalo.org, or you can give us a call, 716-883-1900, and you can buy tickets or get a sponsorship and bring some friends, because it's a fantastic night with food, laughter, and free parking.
And you can support a wonderful cause as well as have something to laugh about for a change. Thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate your taking the time to talk to us on Target. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll be with you again next week, same time, same station. Bye now.
You've been listening to On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at Western New York and our community. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Penny Wolfgang at 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.